Sports Edition, right here on KPFA.
That's right, KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno. And in the Valley of Fresno, it is KFCF. Online, around the world, and archived at kpfa.org. All right, it's 2:30. It's time now for Education Today.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, this is Education Today. Good afternoon and welcome to Education Today. I'm your host, Kitty Kelly Epstein. Today we'll be talking about early childhood education, its availability, its quality, its need in the city of Oakland and in the area of Northern California, how much early childhood is available, particularly to families who don't have a lot of resources. And we'll be talking with Brent Brown from the Insight Center, a group that looks at a lot of important social issues, and he is the expert on this one. Before we do that, I want to give you a couple pieces of education news from this week. The first, the mayor of New York retook control of the New York City schools. He has been running the schools for a couple of years now. The law that authorized him to do that ran out for a few months, and he had that reauthorized. There are mixed reports about its effectiveness, but mayoral control of schools is something we've been seeing a great deal of recently. When schools begin this month, as many as 100,000 of last year's teachers won't have jobs. This will result in an overall drop in education jobs in the U.S. This is the estimate from the Director of Field Operations for the National Education Association, which is the nation's largest teachers union. As we usually do, we're going to ask you, our listeners, to call in with comments and questions at 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425. And you'll be able to call in the next 5 minutes or so to talk with me, ask your questions, give your comments, both to me and to our guest, Brent Brown. And I'm going to be asking him first about some of the research and practice that he's involved in on the issue of early childhood education. Welcome to Education Today, Brent.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you want to tell us a little bit about the work that you do and the organization that you work for?
Right, yeah. I work for the Insight Center for Community Economic Development. We're a national research and consulting organization, but we're based right here in Oakland, California. Our mission is to create opportunity in economically vulnerable communities, and we do that in a number of ways, primarily through early care and education programs to close the racial wealth gap, and workforce development programs, particularly sector-based programs that focus on individual industries.
So in the industry of early childhood, what kinds of issues are you looking at? What do you care about?
Well, at Insight Center, we like to think about early care and education as a tool that helps economically vulnerable communities in three main ways. First, early care and education, when it's high quality, can provide unbelievable learning opportunities for young children so that they enter school ready to learn and ready to succeed. Secondly, the early care and education sector is a major economic driver, generating millions of dollars in the state and providing lots of jobs for people, but particularly people in low-income areas, too. Thirdly, early care and education is a great work support for families that are trying to get off welfare and get into jobs that pay self-sufficiency wages. And that's why we think it's a really important industry to invest in, but particularly to invest in efforts to make sure that it's of adequate quality so that kids are getting a great learning opportunity.
So how do you try as a nonprofit to influence that? How do you try to make that happen since you're a nonprofit that I assume you don't run your own child care center? So how do you try to influence what happens for people?
Well, we do this in a number of ways. We're a leader nationwide in making the economic case for early care and education. So we've worked in states and counties across the nation demonstrating its economic impact. And really making a case that, you know, early care and education is economic development. It is workforce development, and that, you know, funds that go to fund economic development and workforce development should be directed towards early care and education. Another one of our niches is to look at facilities development and financing. I think it's one of the hardest things to look at when you're talking about strengthening the early education sector. Putting together a high-quality facility that is appropriate for early care and education is not an easy undertaking. And the sector has historically been adverse to taking on debt. They're not typically business savvy. So we work on the Building Child Care Project in California, which is a statewide collaborative of a number of partners that pull together resources for early care and education providers that need access to a loan or are going through the facilities development process and they're not familiar with that process.
So from a policy point of view, I assume that you work as you do trying to build the capacity of those small child care providers who currently exist, but is that your preference, or would you rather the state or the feds or somebody set up a whole system of child care that where you weren't trying to assist with the economic development of a lot of what are essentially very small businesses?
That's a great question, Kitty. We'd like to see the state and the federal government get together and adequately fund early care and education. That doesn't mean that we are looking for the state to run early care and education programs. In California and across the country, there are wonderful community-based providers. There's an existing infrastructure of people that have been working in this field for decades. And I think the successful examples of state programs have, you know, started to move towards adequately funding early education, but they brought in the existing providers in those communities to do the work, and they've provided the supports they need to have access to the additional funding. So it's really important as we think as a nation how we want to fund early education to really not look past the fact that there is an existing infrastructure that's been doing this for decades upon decades, and we would really be remiss in, you know, adding just another grade onto our K-12 system that's not working very well. We got a great infrastructure, and we should use it.
Now, that's an interesting point, that maybe this system that's community-based in some ways works better, at least as far as the personalness of the relationship with kids. I would assume that that's an aspect of what's workable about
them. Well, families prefer early care and education to be in their community most often. Sometimes they like it close to where they work, too. But, you know, when they're sending their young children off to early education, they want somebody that's culturally competent. They want someone that's nearby. And this is what, you know, community-based organizations bring. You know, family child care homes and centers. They also typically don't have access to a lot of the capital and other things that they need to make their programs high quality. So we're working right now to assist them in getting those resources. But if you were to, you know, greatly expand funding for early education and you wanted to include these programs, you would have to take extra efforts to make sure that they had access to the funds that you were trying to do, but they're there. And
so what's the trend in terms of funding? Is it getting a little better, a little worse? What's the general trend?
It's been flat. I mean, stimulus funding aside, child care, early care and education in general experienced a significant increase since 1996 after welfare reform. After a few years of the Bush administration, you saw a major plateau in terms of federal investment in early education. There has been a trend towards increased state funding of early education, particularly on state preschool programs for 3 and 4 year olds, usually 4 year olds. In California, we saw an increase and we saw a plateau, and then recently we've seen big hits to all children's programs, but including childcare.
So I'm going to give our phone number again so that people can call in. It's 510-848-4425. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions myself before we take our callers, but our number again at KPFA on Education Today is 848-4425 in the 510 area code, and we're discussing early education today with Brent Brown from the Insight Center. I wanted to ask you a controversial question, or maybe it's not controversial, but kind of a pushback to you, which is, I'm wondering if you have a thought about this. You use the term ready to learn,
mm-hmm.
and I know that's part of the vernacular, right? Everybody talks about kids going to school ready to learn, but it kind of, you know, it's like, every kid's ready to learn. They've been learning since they were born, and the ready to learn terminology seems to me to imply that early childhood has to provide kids with some education and something that they have to know before they get to kindergarten. And that seems to me to set up the deficit model, because if you say that some kids are ready to learn, what you're saying is some other kids are not ready to learn, and they didn't get whatever it was they were supposed to get before they got there, and so now we've already got kids who are ready to flunk kindergarten, basically, is my interpretation. Do you have any response to that?
Well, first of all, ready to learn means a lot of things. Certainly, we don't focus on early education programs that are kill and drill and line kids up and are trying to, force feed them information. High quality early education programs meet kids where they are developmentally on all the important levels, social, emotional, and cognitive too. The brain goes through an amazing amount of development before kids enter kindergarten. And to do that, it needs stimulation. So it needs to be in an environment where they're being exposed to new things, they are being engaged, they're being talked to, they're getting exposed to language, they're getting to talk, they're getting exposed to friends, they're getting exposed to working in groups, they're getting exposed to listening. All those things are really important and, don't necessarily happen when you're sitting in front of a TV or in a situation where the person may not, be specifically trained in child development and understand all the important, amazing things that are going on in a child's mind when they're 1, 2, 3, 4 years old.
So, okay. So here's a topic to for us all to think about. We do have a caller, Paul, from San Francisco. Welcome to Education Today.
Hi, Kitty Kelly. This is Paul Kangas in San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi. I've worked for 30 years with people in jails in the Youth Guidance Center and in the gangs. And the one word, and this deals with your education ready issue, the one word that I have learned in 30 years is that most of these kids that I deal with in the jails are short on a mineral called chromium. And we have a test for it, hair testing. And the police use hair testing on drugs. But in the hair testing, you can see these kids are all deficient in chromium. And they're not getting chromium for three reasons. One, it's not in the food anymore because the whole earth is anemic because the chromium's been used. So the only place you can get it anymore is supplements. Another thing that removes the chromium from their food is sugar and alcohol. So these kids really are not education ready. They're not ready to learn when they get to school simply because they're suffering from ADD, which is caused by a deficiency of chromium. And if we could shift our school system to do one thing, just provide chromium in a supplement form in the grade schools and middle schools, we could turn this issue around. I realize that's probably something you've never heard before.
I haven't, and I appreciate that thought very much, and I'm going to ask Brent if he and his group will look into that and perhaps give us some feedback on
these. You can prove it by looking at hair testing.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much, and before our next caller, we're going to take a little short break, and then we'll be back with you. Again, we're at 510-848-4425, and we look forward to talking with you soon. Can you hear that? Welcome back to Education Today. We're talking today about issues involved in the care and education of young children. We're talking with Brent Brown from the Insight Center, and we are taking calls from you at 510-848-4425. We've discussed a couple topics so far. One is whether child care costs are going up and down, and the other is a little bit about what's appropriate for the education of young children. I'm kind of challenging the concept that kids need to do something special to get, quote, ready to learn before they go to kindergarten. But I'm also interested to hear from you. When people talk about increasing the qualifications for people teaching in early childhood, that's another question I have some reservations about, because just the family-based quality that you're talking about seems potentially to be taking away by demanding credentials, which is something that I've heard some discussion about, some kind of credential for childcare providers. And my experience with credentials in the K-12 system is that it wipes out the community people from the Latino and African American Asian communities, because there's so many hoops and so many expenses, so many different tests, and each one of them cuts out some portion of those community-based people. So I would be concerned about the same impact by having more credentialing of early childhood providers.
Yeah, I think the secret is in how you do it. Certainly the research indicates that teachers that have explicit training in child development tend to provide a higher quality of care. And I say tend because you're going to have people that are specially trained that don't have a way with children. And no matter how much training they have, they won't be as good as someone without that training that just has a way with kids. I believe that some people just have an innate ability to work with children, and you can train them so much. But however, on average, when you look at the research, teachers working with young children that have specific training in early childhood development provide a higher quality of care. The types of interactions that they have with kids are more appropriate. They touch on more aspects of the child, the social, the emotional, and the cognitive. Therefore, there's a compelling reason why you would want as many of the people that are working with our young children every day to have this specialized training as possible. The trick then is to recognize, well, another aspect of quality is having culturally appropriate care and having that care be in a place that families feel comfortable with. And so you don't want to set up a system that drives out an existing infrastructure and is inaccessible to the very people that have been doing this work. So that means that when you're creating these types of systems, you have to build in incentives, both long-term but also short-term, because you have to recognize that early care and education providers do not make a ton of money. They don't have a lot of assets to already invest in their education so they can access this. So you need immediate supports. And I think there's a number of examples nationwide. There's a TEACH program that provides sort of stipends and supports to get early care and education providers the training and education and compensation that they deserve for that education.
That's wonderful. And one of the things I like about the work of your organization is that another of the projects of the Insight Center is work on the closing the racial wealth gap. And again, it's the Insight Center, which is located in Oakland, but works nationally. But I think that recognition probably permeates the work of your organization. We have another caller now, Craig from Midpine. Welcome to Education Today.
Hi. From his responses, it sounds to me like your guest has a pretty good handle on things here. Particularly in responding to your concerns that you raised, which I share largely. I was glad you picked up on the phrase ready to learn. My wife taught as a Head Start Master Teacher for a number of years and then moved into our local community college as human development courses and the like, and a large proportion of her students were people who were going into you know, the field of early childhood education and a lot of, including a lot of currently working daycare providers. Let me see, I want to kind of try to pull a couple of threads together here. First of all, I guess it was last year we had a ballot measure trying to get universal preschool education funding in California.
Yeah, that was Prop 82.
Excuse me?
Prop 82 in 2006, I believe.
Yeah, I forget what year it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it was so much has gone down in the interim. But it went down to defeat. And, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of reasons for it. But it seems to me that it one of the things it came down to was concern about the state taking over the field and basically controlling it. And now a lot of this was fears that were inflamed on the far right, just as we're seeing now with the healthcare debate, you know, which were just exaggerated and really wild. But
so that's a really important question, and I wonder, Brent, since you do policy work on this, how do you deal with that, the fear of the state takeover of something which actually we may not be worried about the state being involved in healthcare, but I think both you and I are a little worried about the state involvement in childhood. So how do you get the funding without that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say one of the reasons why Prop 82 didn't pass was that it didn't get the universal support of the left and far left either. And I think some, you know, there was a lot of reasons, and I certainly don't feel that I could be an expert on why Prop 82 failed, but I know that when it came to getting the support of the community-based providers, it was not explicit enough that they were going to use them. And I think a lot of people had a problem with that, and I think, in my opinion, it's justified. I mean, as much as it would have been great to have additional funding for universal preschool, you need to make sure that the additional funding is going to go to that community-based providers would have an equal access to that funding. And I think that their intention was to include community-based providers, but I don't think they did an adequate job of convincing them that they were going to be included.
Thank you. I hope people who are thinking about a new ballot measure are learning from your discussion and that you're going to be involved in the creation of the next one. We now have Ricardo from Berkeley. Welcome to Education Today.
Hi. Good afternoon. I had a kind of quick question, comment. I wanted to get the speaker's thoughts on the use of, you know, you spoke about culturally sensitive caretaking and kind of the use of language, whether research has indicated one way or the other whether these places should be teaching pure English or different ones, different languages.
You're saying, you're asking about bilingual approaches, perhaps?
Or, you know, whether it's best to do all in English so they can prepare for school, or should they also kind of incorporate other languages?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, this is also an area where I would by no means call myself an expert. I will say that I visited some preschool programs in Los Angeles where they were doing dual language learning. They felt that this was really, really important, both for the parents to attract parents. Parents want their kids oftentimes to learn the language of their home, but they also felt that their children should be exposed to English. So I think if you look at Los Angeles Universal Preschool, there's a great model in how to have a sort of uniform funding mechanism and some basic standards across a whole bunch of programs, but they use, you know, family childcare homes, community centers, and some of their programs happen at a school. And they leave the decision on what language the children should be exposed to up to the community-based provider, except that, you know, they require that at least a part of the day kids are getting exposed to English, because that is the language that they are going to be exposed to in kindergarten. And if you believe strongly that you want to get them ready for kindergarten, exposure to English is important too. But it is so valuable, especially in these times, to have both languages. And what an opportunity preschool could be to to foster dual language learning?
Wonderful question. Thank you for asking it. And the idea that we're trying to subtract kids' language that they speak early on, middle class people or more affluent people are always trying to get their kids to learn a second language. We have a lot of less affluent people who already speak one, and we try to wipe it out. So thank goodness in L.A., at least in the preschool years, they're not doing that to some extent. We have another caller now, maybe our last one, or maybe we might have time for one more. This caller is Deborah from San Francisco. Welcome to Education Today.
Hi there. I just wanted to remind your listeners of an additional resource, the public library. The library, in certainly the last few years, has had a lot of programs that are helping children get ready to read from birth to 5 years old. And they're often multilingual programs, and they're often multi-generational programs. So the grandparents are involved. It's a wonderful way to learn, and it's free. And there are a lot of funders who are interested in funding this kind of program at the library. So
Great, great resource. Thank you for telling us about it.
Yeah.
We also have a resource, at least in Oakland, in the Parks Department, which runs early childhood classes there and has a lot of enthusiasm because they are in the recreation centers in some places that are really accessible. So if in the last minute or so we have, Brent, I wonder if you can give us one last piece of advice to our listeners about what they should do to promote early childhood education. Do we need a new ballot measure? Do we need, what's the big policy thing we should all be working on?
Well, the thing that's coming up most immediately at the federal level are these early challenge grants that are coming up, which give states money to plan for quality, to come up with a plan to really, you know, radically and systemically improve the quality of early education programs. And this bill is so I think it just got out of committee, and I would encourage you to look into it and learn more about it. And I think it's a great opportunity. Another thing that's coming up is TANF and the Child Care Development Block Grant are coming up for reauthorization next year, and it's also a great opportunity to increased funding for early education programs.
Wonderful. Thank you for that information. I think all of us are really worried about how many parents don't have options around what they do when they have to go to work. So we're happy for the work you do, and thank you for sharing it with us. You're listening to KPFA in Berkeley. This is Kitty Kelly Epstein. I'm your host for Education Today. Our producers are Kevin Cartwright and Jaron Epstein, and we appreciate you being with us and look forward to talking with you each second and fourth Friday of the month at 2:30 in the afternoon. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Each week on KPFA Radio's Sunday Sedition, you'll hear a mix of news analysis and discussion on a wide range of topics. We examine hot issues and historical trends, explore neighborhoods and global communities. We discuss arts and culture and feature guests who will engage your mind and move you to action. Of course, listener participation is a key ingredient of the mix. I'm your host, Andrea Lewis, and I hope you'll join us each week on Sunday from 9 to 11 a.m.